This is a Carlisle ValueCast, brought to you by the Carlisle Group. ValueCast brings you insights from our One Carlisle Network, providing analysis, data, and observations to help you navigate the global economy and top-of-mind issues in news. The Carlisle Group. Invest wisely. Create value.
Greetings and welcome to Carlisle ValueCast. I'm Chris Ullman, head of Carlisle's Global Communications. Today we are discussing how Carlisle gathers and uses information from our global portfolio of investments. And our guest is Jason Thomas, Carlisle's Director of Research. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
Jason, so Carlisle has this huge portfolio, more than 200 companies, and you gather a lot of information and data from them on a regular basis. Why do you do this, and what does it tell you?
I'm looking for data, whether it's portfolio company orders, shipments, occupancy rates, rentals, that move up and down predictably with the broader economy. What I'm interested in finding out is, what do the data tell us about the current growth rate in a given economy, a given region, a given sector, and how that growth rate compares to analyst forecasts or the growth rates that are actually embedded in asset prices? And there are times when we can observe growth rates through our portfolio that suggest that current asset prices are too high or too low relative to, again, the growth rates that we're seeing. I'm interested in those companies and those data series that have the most informational value, and very often that's not those that are most representative of the broader economy. For example, when you think about households, most spending is accounted for by rent or mortgage payments or utilities or mobile phone subscriptions, cable subscriptions, that kind of thing. The recurring expenditures that are going to be made no matter how the household feels about its future income prospects, the risk of job loss, et cetera.
So people are going to pay their rent regardless of whether they feel confident in the future.
Exactly. There are certain recurring expenditures that are not likely to move on a month-over-month basis. What you will see that moves are big ticket purchases like durable goods, appliances, for example. The decision to renovate your home or remodel your kitchen is going to depend on how secure you feel about your job prospects. So when you see appliance sales pick up, it's a sign of consumer confidence in the economy. Car sales are similar in that regard. Also, the decision to take a vacation. One of my favorite data series that we've had since I've worked at Carlisle were Hertz rentals. We could segment rentals by those that are for household relative to those that are part of a business account or those from the government. And those leisure rentals, they had quite a bit of informational value to help forecast U.S. consumption spending. We saw those fall at the end of 2006, which is over a year prior to the onset of recession. So they were already sending information about declining discretionary spending, about declining household confidence in the future that could have helped to inform judgments about what would ultimately happen in the consumer space and in the broader economy. Similarly, they started to rebound sharply at the end of 2009 into 2010, which provided confidence that incipient recovery would continue.
What are some of the companies and data that you look at today that are cyclically sensitive?
I'm very interested in auto sales and auto shipments. That not only reflects confidence in the future, the shipments of specific types of autos reflects views about the future path for gasoline prices, for example. And it also helps to look at the types of vehicles that are purchased to estimate whether the demand for autos is being satisfied by domestic versus foreign producers. Domestic auto producers, of course, are more competitive in the light truck space. So if you see Chevy Silverado pickup trucks jumping off the lots, that's a signal both that people are generally confident that gasoline prices are going to remain low, but also that this is going to be better for the U.S. economy because more of the industrial production that is being made to meet household demand is occurring inside the United States than elsewhere. Thinking about abroad, in Europe, very interested in two series. First is a consumer electronics series, and then also women's lingerie and other apparel, swimwear, those kinds of luxury apparel purchases. There are, again, those sorts of spending categories that tend to move up and down predictably with the broader economy. We also have a discretionary travel booking series in Brazil that we follow very closely. That's been demonstrated to have a great deal of predictive power for broader retail sales. And then also two hotel chains in China, where we can look at leisure occupancy rates for households in 36 cities. And we can use those data to make judgments about the strength of the Chinese consumer. So this is very much a global effort. And again, in each case, we're looking for those series where the spending is going to be very closely related to discretionary income and then confidence about the future.
You're communicating with the portfolio. It is effectively talking to you. What are you doing with this knowledge you're getting?
We put together a report every month that estimates the current pace of growth across countries, across industries, and sectors. Those are made available to our fund heads, to our investment professionals, so that they can see how the growth rates we're observing today compare to the growth rates that are being used for a prospective deal. You can compare the growth rates that we're observing today relative to those that are being presented by the seller or the advisor about the likely growth going forward. And very often that'll involve consultations. By showing the relationship between that segment and the economy, we can make conditional statements so that if you're expecting a certain level of GDP growth, then you would expect this amount of sales prospectively. Secondly, is to get expected returns based on the growth rates that we're observing, so that a given ratio can be used with current growth rates you're observing to estimate the expected return over a five-year window. That helps get a sense at a more macro level of where expected returns are high, where expected returns are low, and where our investors should be thinking about perhaps increasing relative composition of their portfolio.
So how good are you at predicting what's coming? What's your track record?
Well, I always like to say that you're never wrong. It was just the wrong time that you you made the forecast. The way that the forecasts are updated is based on the new incoming information. We try not to make radical changes or overreact to the data. So our forecasting record is very good because we're very slow to adjust. If what I tell you today is radically different than what I told you 3 to 6 months ago, there's probably something wrong with the estimation because economic trends don't change that swiftly. So the balance that I try to strike is between not missing turns that are really significant, while at the same time not overreacting to every twist and turn in the data.
How do you differentiate between company-specific challenges or progress versus what's going on in the broader economy?
What we're interested in is whether the company growth rate goes up or down at the same time as the macro. So what that means is that maybe you have a company that's growing at 6 or 8%, while at the same time the broader aggregate you're tracking is growing at 3%. We would not be so silly as to suggest that because we're observing 6% growth, therefore the sector is growing at the same rate. An example of this, an old portfolio company was HD Supply. There was a period of time when HD Supply's construction material sales were growing quite rapidly. And internally, it was not clear whether this was attributable to their increasing market share or whether it was actually a sign that the housing market had finally turned around.
How unique is this approach among investment firms?
My understanding is that many other investment firms rely more on financial data from their companies, so their sales, earnings, things like that. I think what really differentiates our approach is the use of non-traditional metrics. So if a company is active in acquisitions, I'm really not interested in its sales because its sales have moved up because of acquisitions, that it's not organic sales. It doesn't tell you about the economy. It tells you that this company acquired a lot of competitors or additional rail, et cetera. So we're very interested in same store analysis, which is a term to reflect a constant mix of businesses or a constant mix of stores, a constant mix of hotels, a constant mix of rooms, a constant mix of customers.
Now, I've known you for a number of years now, and you are a rather sober gentleman in the way you approach things. So when everyone's losing their heads over the falling price of oil and gasoline and the like, how do you perceive that situation?
When you have a systematic process for updating your expectations from month to month, it helps you to keep you grounded. Because, again, if the latest number on personal income comes in down 2%, and it's a big shock because market participants only expected it to be down 1%, then you're already predisposed to think that this is a bigger problem than it actually is. And if you appreciate instead that most of the incoming data is going to be buffeted by random variation, then you're going to take a more grounded approach and extract just that portion of the incoming information that helps you to change your view relative to the prior month. I think just maintaining an appreciation for how slow-moving some of these economic processes are helps to keep you grounded, level, and not overreact to incoming information.
A few months ago, you wrote a commentary published in the Wall Street Journal that argued that though energy is a relatively small part of the U.S. economy, its potential impact on the broader economy should not be underestimated. So tell us a little bit about that.
When I was at the National Economic Council in 2006, many observers suggested we should not be worried about the housing problems that we were experiencing at the time because fixed residential investment only accounted for 5 or 6% of GDP. So when people said very similar arguments about the downturn in oil, I was immediately reminded of that experience. First, with oil, what we noticed from the portfolio over the last 5 or 6 years was that industrial equipment spending became more and more energy dependent. We had a company, Allison Transmission, that made transmissions for oil rigs used in hydraulic fracturing. And this grew to be a really sizable share of its total book of business. And looking throughout the portfolio, you noticed that in intermediate goods, things like, again, engines, transmissions, pumps, machine tools, precision parts, more of the final demand for these products was related to energy. So even though mining for oil and gas accounts for something like 2% of GDP, it generates demand for large amounts of machinery, equipment, and helps sustain growth in manufacturing. Our estimates, based also on Fed capacity data, suggest that energy equipment, energy investment, accounted for about 70% of net industrial investment between 2009 and 2014. So if the downturn in energy and oil led to a collapse in equipment orders, then this could have much greater effects than mining's 2% of GDP would suggest.
Let's look at our investing in China, Jason. What's our data telling us, and how are we reacting to that?
What's most interesting to me about China are the resurgence in property development. Right now, data through April of 2016 suggest that transaction volumes, the total amount of square meters of floor space transacted in tier one cities in China, has essentially doubled relative to 2015. And that increase has taken down the unsold inventory of property. So property development over the last 2 years in China has slowed dramatically and in fact subtracted from GDP growth in 2015 because there was this huge unsold inventory that inhibited new construction. So that decline in inventory suggests that property development in the second half of the year could actually pick up and be a meaningful contributor to growth. We also look very closely at demand for industrial materials through a company where we have exposure to about 18 mines in Western Australia and in Northern Australia. And the extraction of these commodities is generally to meet demand in China. But right now, it seems as though a bottom has been reached and a more sustainable equilibrium has been found.
Jason, thank you for a very interesting discussion about how data from our investment portfolio helps us understand the economy's path and informs our investment decisions. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on Carlyle ValueCast.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, go to our website at www.carlyle.com. This has been a Carlyle ValueCast podcast.